Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Placer, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugbeat Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And our special guest tonight from Zachtronic Industries, is that it?
Yep.
Owner and creator behind the hit game Space Camp, Zach Barth.
Hello.
So, I know we are definitely late about talking about Space Camp. It came out
two years, four months, ish.
You know, with the video game industry, if you're not, like, out in, like, the first month or two, you know, you're old news by then.
Yeah. Okay, well, in that case, it's ancient.
Yeah. So, Space Camp, definitely an interesting game. I talked about this about a week or so ago. It's still on my list of games I would like to beat at some point, but it's, you know, it's just, you know, kicking my butt all over the place. So, let's begin with talking a little bit about how the design came about. What led you into creating Space Camp?
Yeah, I mean, so Space Camp is... It's actually probably the latest game in a long line of games that I've made. They're all sort of like engineering puzzle games. And it started with a game called Manufactoid that was inspired by the show How It's Made, where, you know, it's just all about factories. And sort of the idea of that, you know, building a lot of games, you know, might have you build like a final thing, you know, but it's kind of more fun to build something that builds that final thing. So like building machines, building factories, and that created a game called Manufactoid, then made a game called The Codex of Alchemical Engineering, and then made Space Camp.
Cool. Now, before the cast, you talked about, you were talking about how you were making educational games before then. I assume those would be like Manufactoid.
Not before then, actually after.
Ah.
The, so we've been making some educational games lately as part of a big new educational gaming initiative, and, we actually, the only reason we are involved with that is because somebody saw Space Camp and was like, well, this game is not that educational, but this, you know, it looks like these people could be good at making educational games. And we got in and made some STEM, some like science games for them.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing about Space Camp is that it looks like from the outside that it's supposed to teach you about chemistry, but it really doesn't.
Yeah. It's a little fraction frogs in that regard that it looks more educational than it actually is.
And that's how I got first introduced to Space Chem, is we were making a project having to do with chemistry, and we're like, what game has to do with teaching chemistry? We're like, Space Chem. So that's the first game we went to. That's how we found out about the game.
Yeah, it's kind of about chemistry. There are other games that are more about chemistry. There's I think they made it for like an Intel like netbook game challenge, and it's a lot more about chemistry because it has like the things bond automatically, and that's sort of an important part of it. So that's sort of like a key part of chemistry, that bonding happens automatically, not at your whim.
Yeah, I just think it's cool that you gain that kind of awareness that's the first game you thought of. And a lot
yeah, that is good, that. Yeah. We've successfully advertised it. No, that's, yeah. You've seen all the bulletin boards that we put up, you know, I'm joking, we haven't we've spent like $50 on advertising.
Well, it was actually TF2 that actually also...
Oh, yeah, Space Camp. TF2 promotion. That was great.
You were one of the first big ones that I remember was Space Camp and TF2.
Yeah, it was that was very cool. That was free. That's the best kind of advertising.
Yeah. Now regarding edutainment titles, I guess before or after Space Camp, have you looked at like any of like the I guess more recognizable edutainment games like Incredible Machine, Zumbinis or anything like that to like help you with your design?
No, I mean, so Space Camp was never meant to be educational. So, did not look at any prior art for educational games, just sort of made a game that seemed like it'd be a good game. And I guess it's sort of that, like, my background, I'm not afraid of, you know, things that sound educational. You know, like, I'm not a huge fan of chemistry as a discipline, but, like, I don't, you know, our thought process going into making the game was that, well, there's certainly nothing wrong with theming a game around chemistry. We're not exactly correct in that regard, but sort of our natural instincts were that there's nothing wrong with that.
Now that you're working on an education initiative, are you looking at more educational games now as you design, as references?
Not really anymore, actually. A lot of the context of the project is that a big company that's building a digital curriculum for tablets, went out and looked at independent developers and, like, so people who weren't established making educational games, people who made other kinds of games that were successful for different reasons, and sort of going to them and saying, what would you do if you built an educational game? So we've been developing, basically developing educational games from first principles of game design, instead of copying what other people have done, with the idea being that most people haven't done that great of a job, sort of developing it from scratch and seeing what we've come up with. And we've made some games that are pretty much, I mean, that are unlike what you would consider traditional educational games, definitely.
Because yeah. there's always that big disconnect in educational games between the information and the play itself. And that's always been a big problem when doing crafting entertainment games.
We're kind of blasé about it, I think, that more so that, like, we definitely focus on making a game, and if it happens to be educational, then that's awesome.
Yeah, but I think that's like probably the way to go about it, yeah.
It's a way. I mean, there's definitely people who disagree, and I've definitely, like, had other educational game designers scoff at us because that's our philosophy, because there's other people who do it more professionally than we do, and they're going to clients and telling them that they can make them educational games, and they're saying that, yeah, if you give us a list of kind of curriculum points or whatever, we'll guarantee that they're in there. Like, that is not how we operate. You know, we're lucky if they get in there, you know, or if we can find one that fits to the game. So, like, coming at it from the other direction.
Right, you know, and they have to give some, like, solid results using metrics and numbers and research and making sure that things fit certain protocols. I mean, sure, that's the other camp, you know?
Or maybe you don't. Yeah, that's the other camp. That's not what we do. I mean,
exactly.
there's sort of a problem there where it's not even, like, the metrics that people use are necessarily, like, would be able to detect the kind of learning that could possibly happen with games, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, the standard way to analyze whether somebody has learned something or not, like, standardized tests, multiple choice tests, you know? Like, that's the standard way to do it. Like, could a multiple choice test really capture the advantages of a game, or is it just completely oblivious to it? Well, you know, I mean, is it possible that the best way to test, like, whether or not a game was effective at teaching something is with a test that is a game itself?
Right, I mean,
practical application, basically.
Exactly, or practical application or something. So there's sort of the, and that's as we've kind of dug more into education, you know, coming at education from as outsiders, just realizing that, you know, a lot of your conclusions that you can detect depend on how you're trying to detect them. And if you have bad testing measures, you know, or like insufficient testing measures, you know, like, can you even get the research results you want?
Right, and I think there's a big, when people are in the industry go and make games, there's a big trapping of all these protocols they need to follow and all these restrictions of what they can and can't do. But if you go in just to make a fun game with educational elements, I think you have a better, bigger impact and you're used to the medium better.
Yep. And we've been blessed that our handlers are very much of the latter opinion of just kind of letting us go do our thing as game designers and then trying to handle the protocol or, you know, remove the protocol as much as possible. And I'm convinced at this point that we would not be making educational games if we didn't have someone to sort of free us from those normal burdens of it. Because very early, long ago, we thought, you know, after Space Camp, but before these educational games, we thought it'd be fantastic to make educational games because games are so powerful for learning, and it seemed like such a good idea. But the reality is, yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of just cruft there that's kind of stifling, but we lucked out.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely seems like when you look at just like edutainment games in general these days, they definitely fall more on, as you talk about, the opposite side, where it's about the education, you know, first actual playing the game, you know, fourth or fifth down the line.
And that doesn't even get to the even bigger problem, which is who the hell's going to buy them? It's like, oh, you could sell it direct to parents. It's like, yeah, if you want to make $10, you know, like, you're going to make individual sales one at a time, and it's going to suck.
Yeah,
because right, it's force-fed, too, to the kid. Because the parents find, like, you had to play this game. It's educational.
Yeah, not always. I mean, I guess it's at their discretion what the case is.
There's going to be a stigma, though, as soon as they heard education game.
Well, that's why you don't call it we don't call them educational games.
Oh, no, I'm talking about in the past. That's what's always been the way.
Well, yeah, but that's the stupid people doing it. I mean, there's you have to solve a lot of marketing problems and a lot of distribution problems. You know, there's no equivalent of Steam for, like, educational games. And even then, like, would it have edu in the title? You know, there's lots of problems. So I'm glad that we didn't have to solve that problem, that we can just skip to the part with making games, which is the fun part.
Yeah. Now, one aspect that I'm curious about is, what age group or grade level are you, like, focusing on right now for your games?
Middle schoolers.
Okay.
It's not that's just the nature of the project.
Yeah. Have you looked at, like, elementary or high school? Like, are there, like, any differences in, like, how you would, like, skew your design towards those different age groups?
I have no idea. I think that sort of where I come from, I would, if I got to pick who I would make games for, I would say college students. Yeah. Because that's sort of the... I have a bad habit of making complicated game designs, like, if you look at Space Camp. And things that would probably work, you know, like, in kind of... if you were to apply that to educational material, I think it would work best with, like, college level, just because it's sufficiently technical to make sufficiently technical games about. I best understand it. I don't remember very much. I definitely don't have kids and don't remember what it was like to be an elementary schooler. So, and not to mention, like, I have no idea what you know, like, elementary schoolers think is cool, or middle schoolers think is cool nowadays. But college students, I get that. I could totally... That, I feel like, would be my natural setting.
Yeah. And speaking about Space Chem, we can... That's a great way to pull back, talking a little bit about the design of the game.
Yeah.
I guess one area that I found fascinating about the game that I talked about in my piece was how you basically design these puzzles to be nonlinear.
Yeah.
What was, like, the general mindset of developing the content to work in, you know, a multitude of different ways?
It's the formula of... I did a talk on GDC about this. Okay. That sort of the... A lot of puzzle games, and it's sort of... I mean, it's not a puzzle game in particular, but puzzle games in general. It seems that the way people design the puzzles is that they sort of build, like, a puzzle, you know, like a puzzle language or whatever, your puzzle mechanics, and then you've designed specific puzzles, and a common way to do this is to set up a solution and then sort of delete pieces of it until, like, you have a something that's solvable by the player inserting the pieces that you deleted or something equivalent to it. I'm like, that's a pretty simple way. I actually, we did a paper version of Space Chem. It's a little puzzle booklet, and it's much less open-ended. It's much more of a traditional puzzle, and the way I started designing it in the Space Chem style of being open-ended, and it was impossible. Like, they just didn't work out, so I came up with a bunch of specific solutions and then deleted pieces of it, and that was how I made the puzzles. And it's actually a very successful method, but it creates very linear puzzles where there's only one or two solutions. With Space Chem, the way we created puzzles was to define a very rich set of puzzle mechanics. So that, I mean, it's basically like a programming language, you know, it's not a real programming language. You'd have a hard time doing anything with it, like, in terms of real programming problems. But we designed a programming language and environment, and then created very open-ended, just sort of, just build this, you know, and it was almost such a vague, like, it was a specific, but, like, it was very vague about how you accomplished it, if you look at the mechanics. And, the way you test to see if it's solvable is just to have people try.
Yeah. And that's one of the interesting things about Space Chem. It's one of the few puzzle games where you can actually track, you know, how well you stand your solution compared to everyone else who played it.
Exactly. And it's the puzzles are really like programming assignments. Like, if I were to say, you know, write an algorithm that sorts a list of numbers, you know, there are many different, like, there are many different ways to solve it, and that problem doesn't sort of require a single solution. And because there are so many different possible solutions, you can start scoring them on metrics like how fast is it, how efficient is it, and that worked in Space Chem too. Like, does the concept ported over 100%?
Yeah. With this other type of levels, when you actually have multiple reactors, that added, like, a little bit more of a game element, because you also had to manage the space and basically, you know, the terrain, you know, managing where the pipes went and all that.
Yep. It's actually very similar to the, like, it's I don't think it's that much more gamey. It's just like an alternate set of mechanics, but it's equally Space Chem-y as the core mechanics.
Yeah.
Because it's still, like, it's not fun, so it's not that gamey, you know. But you know, you have a set of space, like, limited space, just like in the simple Space Chem levels, and then you have to choose where to put the things in that space to carry it out. So it's cool because it's like an orthogonal mechanic set, which just explodes the design space.
Now, with being able to, like, just see the solutions and rate them, were there any of them that, you know, surprised you when you saw some solutions that people came up with, you know, on YouTube, and just, like, the general ratings for how they got?
So I didn't dig through a lot of the solutions, but and I doubt I could look at a solution and tell you whether it was super clever or not, but what you do see coming out are not just specific solutions, but techniques. So it's sort of like one like abstraction level above a clever solution is a clever technique, and where people figured out, here's a general purpose way that you can exploit the mechanics of the game to be generally more efficient. It's sort of like how, you know, in programming, you can, like, a, you know, assembly programming, you can inline loops, and it'll, you know, it's a technique that you can do that makes it so it's better in one regard and worse in another regard when it comes to optimization. People came up with stuff like that for Space Chem. So one trick that you can do is, like, Space Chem's all about loops, typically, but you can actually kind of squish loops together if you're careful about how you do it and make things that just bounce in a straight line back and forth. And that shaves a couple instructions off, and it shaves a couple cycles off because you don't have to go, you know, if you're going left or right, you don't have to go up or down anymore. You don't have to waste time traveling up or down to get to new space. You can just bounce left and right. And or there's another trick where if an atom goes off, like crashes into the edge of the reactor, it stops the playback. But if a Waldo, one of the little grabber arms, goes into the side, it's totally okay with it. And it'll just keep repeating the one instruction in that same space. So people came up with this technique. It's called stalled Waldo. And it's a very instruction, you know, it only takes like one instruction instead of eight to do something every cycle with a single Waldo. So that's like a huge improvement if you're getting really, like, really micro-optimization-y. That's a general technique that you can apply to any level if you want to, if you're doing that certain optimization. So again, exactly like programming.
Yeah, I should be writing some of this down. It should help me when I'm going back to.
Yeah, there's like wikis and stuff where people compiled it all together. There's some really crazy techniques.
Yeah, I saw when I was writing about. I think the one that I saw that was that you could really start to get conflict was with a whole sync command when you set up one to go to another, and then when you throw in the conditionals, like when it brings in a certain element, you can say go here or there, and that's basically just an if-then statement.
Yep.
And yeah, that can really get complex. I was trying to do the efficiency expert achievement, and it took me like 2 hours to figure out how to do that all in one reactor.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, I was so happy, and then I saw the result. I saw all my friends did in, like, half the time, half the wall. They're like, damn. No. Yeah. I should just go to bed now. Now, the other type of levels that you have were, I guess, the boss, I guess. We call them like the boss levels, so when you have to deal with some kind of situation.
Yeah.
Where did the inspiration for those come from?
Oh, just that it seemed awesome. It's a little bit, I'm guessing, at this point, to be honest, I don't fully remember why, where that came from. That was definitely the first revision of the game. Like, you know, we started the game like a year and a half before we finished it. That was one of the very first ideas, was that we're going to have this puzzle environment, and then you're going to have pipelines, and then we're going to make the pipelines more awesome by having it so you fight off monsters. Originally, we thought it would be more like a tower defense puzzle, where there's actually, like, sort of gamey, like, loose combat elements to it. But it turned out that it was very, like, if you can't predict how the combat's going to go down, you're going to have a very hard time of constantly changing and, you know, like, having to, like, say you have to put down turrets that shoot at things, and you have to create a complex chemical pipeline to power those turrets. Well, you do that, you play down your turrets, you create a complex chemical pipeline, but it turns out your turrets aren't in quite the right positions, you have to move them, and then you have to completely reprogram everything to support it. So Space Chem already has a sort of bad, like a really way too long feedback loop, where it takes far too long to find out whether or not your idea actually is going to work. And if we were to add that extra level of the sort of tower defense abstraction of like fuzzy numbers and things with health points coming in randomly, I think that we sort of predicted early on that it would be way too hard to play. Like, you would just spend so much time redoing your solutions, and it'd be so frustrating. So we switched over to bosses that are very specific in how they work and very mechanical. So there's none of those problems. But that was definitely something that we came up with. So it's actually probably the worst part of the game, are the boss levels. Because even though they don't have monsters coming in at different locations with chunky health bars and, you know, all those difficulties, you can't tell how the monster is going to fully work. And so the way you have to sort of figure out how the monster works is by trying to build a solution and then seeing if that sort of, you know, like if you think about the pyramid monster, you have to shoot him in the eye with particle beams, but only when his eyes open. And it's not obvious until you build a machine that this isn't working most of the time, but sometimes it works. And then if you're lucky enough, you'll realize it only works when the eyes open. But then you still have to go back and build another machine. So there's a lot of unnecessary, unfun kind of iteration, and makes it probably, if you look at a graph of when people quit playing the game, they're more likely to quit on one of those levels than one of the other levels, like significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that I was reading the recent piece on Kama Sutra about your conversation and about some of the difficulties with Space Chem, and that, and one of the areas that I also saw about was the general, like, the tutorial aspect of the game.
Oh, yeah. And, terrible tutorial. Yeah. It's bad.
Yeah, I think, and it does sort of, I guess, hurt the accessibility, because as we talked about earlier, the game is completely open-ended, so you have really no idea, you know, what, you know, player A's skill level is going to be at the same part as player B. And you were just talking about, you know, all the little tricks of people and, you know, general applications they found to alter the Waldos that, you know, is great applications, but, you know, your general guy probably has no idea what those are, just like me.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, no, I mean, nobody started the game knowing what they were. It's that no one was born knowing how to play Space Chem. Everybody had to learn and figure it out. The consequence, though, is that the game is nothing like any other game that's been out. There's, you can't pull any experience from any other game. Maybe if you'd had some programming background, like you sort of got some of the same circuits formed in your brain that help you play it. But no one knows how to play Space Chem. So it sort of just shows, like, you know, as people play it, like, just better play. Some people will be better at it. Some people will be less good. And it just sort of happens. Like, no amount of tutorial could change that. Like, it's just too complicated of a game. It's too demanding, you know? Like, it really matters who you are when you're playing the game, not just are you paying attention to the tutorial.
Looking back at it now, do you see, like, any areas that you think you could, like, improve or tweak to make the game easier to understand?
Absolutely. It's not like, if there was something that was easy enough, we would have done it, but systematically, we could have completely designed a different game that was easier to learn and play. But then it would be a different game, so.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, and that's what you were talking about earlier with how traditional puzzle design is you're just taking a puzzle and you're taking apart enough elements to leave it for the player to figure out. So on one hand, it's easy to learn, but then it's incredibly linear. But with a game like Space Chem, there is no, you know, there's nothing really that you could, like, take out. Like, if you try to limit it, it would just, you know, it wouldn't really be Space Chem anymore, basically.
Yeah, and there's smart stuff that we could do, you know, to make a game like that better, but we're very much, I think, at a local maxima where, you know, we could have changed a bunch of things and every one of them would have made the game worse. And in order to get to a higher maxima than where we were, you know, we would have had to go stray very far from where the game was. And we hadn't launched the game, so we hadn't seen how people reacted to it. You know, you really don't learn. I mean, I guess you could do a whole bunch of playtesting and then you'd have an idea, but we didn't do a whole bunch of playtesting. We did a tiny bit of playtesting, and we really learned about how the game worked and how people played it, like, months after releasing it. And it's just sort of inevitable. I mean, I don't know. Like, now we design games differently. You know, we've got a little bit more on the line. We have to have a little bit more certainty that, you know, the game will be able to do well and we'll be able to mesh with players better. But, I mean, still, you really don't know how something does until you release it.
Definitely. Now, one question I have regarding the design. When you create Space Chem, you basically gave the player a huge toolbox of Waldos and commands to use and to figure out. Mm-hmm. Was there anything that got left on the drawing board when you were designing Space Chem in terms of additional Waldo commands or additional challenges?
There's some stuff that we cut. I mean, there was nothing that got left. I mean, there were things that got cut because we didn't want them. Mm-hmm. So I guess that counts as being left on the drawing board. That, like, originally we had a notion of reactors having registers in them, which is basically like a numerical counter. And there's an instruction that would increase it and decrease it. There was another instruction that would branch if it was equal to zero or a specific value.
Okay.
So we had that in the original one, but it actually did not add much. Like, you could kind of pull off all those things with a sync instruction much more tersely, and it added a whole bunch of complexity and confusing that when new players see that and think, oh, I have to use that? It's like, no, you don't have to. You can use it if you want. Like, that's not a good kind of, you know, something that's redundant and confusing should be cut. So we cut that. We also, there's something else. We originally, towards the end of the game, we wanted to have a set of, like, sort of like quantum inspired pieces and reactors where, like, if you moved there was a piece that was fixed and, like, if you moved an atom over it, suddenly it would, like, teleport over to the other side and split or something, like, where, like, there were just these bizarre passive effects to kind of capture, because towards the end of the game we wanted to capture a sense of, like, the reality, like, the rules of reality were sort of breaking down as you got closer towards the, you know, like, the monsters in the game, and we wanted to have things sort of breaking down, but we couldn't figure out any mechanics that were that were good. Like, they were all really stupid, not properly emergent, and didn't seem like they would add a lot to the game. So we ended up just copying out and making these ridiculous made-up elements that can't be transmuted, can have 12 bonds each, and just unlocked, like, really ridiculously not possible structures. So
now, earlier you talked about how, generally speaking, most people would, you know, get stuck at one of the boss sections and would quit at that point.
Yes.
From, like, your metrics, what was, like, the average of, like, how far, you know, the general populace got in playing Space Chem?
How would you define how far the average?
I would say maybe, like, what planet they would reach.
Number of players. Like, only 50% of players, I guess this includes things. We have some graphs, but I'm not entirely sure, like, how much of demo players are on this.
Okay.
But less than half of people who start the game, I would say a third of people who boot up the game, get to the first level at the, like, after the demo.
Okay.
So there's a planet, like, the fourth planet is the, because you get the first three planets in the demo, which is far too many. No, you get the first, is it just the first two? No, I think it's the first three. You get the first three planets in the demo. So the fourth planet is the first stuff that's outside of the demo. Only like a third or a quarter of players who start up the game get to that point. So the average player quits like at the end of the demo.
Well, at least I beat the curve then. I'm right now, I think I'm like the second or third to the end on the fourth planet.
Oh yeah, that's like easily like 10%, less than 10% of people.
Ooh,
it's sort of once you get to the fifth or sixth planet, it's pretty flat. But then once you get to the last planet, a lot of people drop out. It's the last one's super hard, and that's where a lot of people quit. Also, but there's people quit constantly throughout the whole thing. I imagine any game's gonna look like this, right? Like, you're not gonna have more people, you know, quitting. I guess you're always gonna lose players. You're not gonna gain players somewhere like towards the end, because you would have never lost them then. So,
Now, one thing on our previous podcast, we talked a little bit about, we got into discussion about achievements mm-hmm. in video games, whether they're good or bad thing. Now, with Space Chem, was the inclusion of achievements, was that a conscious decision from the start, or was that like added in like near like the end of the development?
It was towards the end. We wanted to have some, like, a notion of, we called them challenges. Just a notion of, like, here, like, call out some special challenges that make sense on some levels. They're pretty arbitrary. I don't think that many people cared about them. Not really. I think the whole, like, achievements are a big deal thing is kind of, like, past. I mean, like, everybody's going to keep doing it out of habit, but I don't think anybody cares about it anymore. It seems to me to be, like, an artifact of the Xbox Live Arcade. Or Xbox Live thing, where the gamer points. Like, who the hell? I haven't heard anybody say the word gamer points in at least a year. If not longer.
I think, Kent, didn't you make fun of that on our last chat?
Yeah, we had a talk with Clay, and they said on Xbox Live, it's a requirement to have a certain amount of achievements for all your games, which then cripples you to a degree if you want a certain type of immersion, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I could see that, yeah. Because they do, like, you're doing something serious, you complete, like, an important moment in the story, and then it pops up a little thing, achievement unlocked! And it's like, that killed the drama. That's right, I remember now I'm playing a video game, not experiencing something that's real and matters.
Yeah, and because of the requirements of the achievements, a lot of people just haphazardly put them in there. They're like, well, you finished chapter one achievement, you know, you shot a gun achievement, you know, so.
Yeah.
They're not really...
So we're gonna...
Go ahead.
We're going to have achievements in Ironclad Tactics, but they're going to be, like, appropriate fun places. But honestly, I think we could just as easily not have them, and it would probably be okay. I just don't think anybody cares about achievements anymore. I don't know. That just might be me being out of touch, but...
It's definitely, like, one of those things that is debated sometimes among certain gamer circles. I know with Don't Star, which we talked to Clay about last week,
mm-hmm.
they like a lot of their fan base is sort of polarized on, you know, some people like having the achievements, while others feel it really does distract from the overall experience. Especially when you have to, you know, sort of chase them and, you know, do stuff that's completely against what the general game is.
I think achievements are very much something that was big before people started thinking seriously about the reward mechanisms in their games. So sort of, I mean, like, that's if that's one good thing that Farmville's done is make people start thinking about your in-game reward structures and how you get people engaged in building desire in the game. And I think that's completely destroyed anybody giving a shit about achievements for real. You know, because, like, experience points. Like, I would much rather have a game, you know, like Battlefield, where you get experience points and can unlock cooler stuff by playing the game than by having it say, like, oh, you got 50 headshots. Like, no one cares. I don't know. That's where my philosophy is right now as a game designer, looking at the zeitgeist.
Yeah, and I'm pretty much the same way. I think achievements only work at their best if there's some kind of, like, tangible or in-game reward for actually getting them.
Exactly. And then it's not even like an achievement, right? Like, that's just a game mechanic. That's what we, in Ironclad Tactics, you unlock cards by playing the game. We build like a huge reward structure around that because it actually matters. Like, no, I really doubt that anybody would care about the achievements in it just because we've got something that's much more, like, taking the place of it, that's much more valuable and fun.
Right. That's when I first heard about achievements or started playing games on Xbox Live, I assumed that I could use my gamer scores to get something, but I actually found out it was just a number. It's pretty much a letdown.
Yeah, well, in TF2, they had the thing where you would use the achievements to unlock the new weapons, and that was, and like when they started releasing them, that was super fun. Like, that was totally a thing that mattered.
Yeah, now they changed the structure after they've done all the meat stuff. So.
Yep. So now they've changed the structure to a different reward, you know, like a different kind of reward structure, but, you know, probably one that's more effective.
I feel like a lot of the things in TF2 are, at least in terms of reward stuff, has become a lot more cryptic. So they allow the community, they give like little clues in their trailers and stuff, and then people decrypt it, and then they figure it out, and then someone shares a technique to get a certain item that was hidden through crafting and stuff. So that's how I see it now, at least.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about Team Fortress 2, you talked about Ariel with the whole Mustachium aspect, that was Valve doing that. How did that come about? Did they approach you, or did you approach them with that concept?
So I got an email from Robin Walker, because we're in Washington State. They're in Washington State. Got an email from Robin Walker. He's like, hey, you want to go to lunch? So we did. So we went out to lunch with them. We talked about Space Cam. We talked about Team Fortress. We talked about the idea of having a promotion of Space Cam items in Team Fortress and then putting a puzzle, like a Space Cam puzzle in, you know, a Team Fortress. At first, we talked about, like, you know, putting a Space Cam puzzle in Team Fortress, but since we already had the engine doing Space Cam puzzles, we figured it'd be easier to make TF2 themed puzzles in Space Cam. And so we did. And we added them, and they did a promotion about it. We sold a ton of copies of Space Cam with people trying to get the items.
And that was, like, at the start of all the promotional stuff with TF2 tie-ins and stuff. I remember Space Cam being the biggest one, one of the biggest ones.
I would say it was probably smaller than some of the other. They had other real games that were using it. We were one of the smaller games, but it was still, I mean, it was at the beginning, and it was back when, I don't know what the popularity of TF2 is, but it was back when I was playing it, so I sort of, after 500 hours, I'm sort of done with it now. But, you know, that was back when it was definitely, like, still in it, like, running strong.
We can still craft some of your the rewards from Space Cam.
Absolutely.
It's one of the only ones, actually, you can do, is Space Cam.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, the Humble Bundle. When we released Space Cam in the Humble Bundle, it came with Steam keys, which unlocked, you know, like, when you get a Steam key, you can get those items. So what it actually had the effect of doing is that it took these items that were actually kind of rare and kind of valuable and completely destroyed the value of them. And I actually got an email from a fan, probably not so much a fan of our games, but as a fan of TF2 and the item stores, who was mad that we completely devalued his items, and was like, can you guys make it so, like, all everybody who had it before the Humble Bundle, that these ones are, you know, original or authentic or vintage or whatever
the
term is?
Vintage, yeah.
And I emailed Robin Walker, but they never wrote back. I don't think they really care about it, you know? So the answer was no. But we affected the market. The fish cake market.
That's just a very interesting market, though, the whole place, the whole commodity market of hats and metal.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I was just looking at is I saw on your site you had a limited edition physical print of Space Cam, and that was actually a Kickstarter that you did last year. What was the path of going about that? Normally, we don't. Usually, when there's a physical copy, that's usually done, you know, when the game's originally released. Of course, this came out several years later.
Yeah. The reason why is because I don't think anybody would have bought a physical copy when they hadn't played the game and didn't love it. So, what we did with this is, you know, we knew that we actually did a small run of physical copies in the past. Like, just, you know, it was a very, very small run, and we sold out of them. And, but it was annoying because we sold out of them over, like, a couple of months, so we had to go to the post office constantly. And we had a lot of fans who wished they'd gotten one when we did it the first time. And they're like, can you do another run? But we had no desire of running to the post office 100 times to mail out little copies. So we did a Kickstarter. Because the Kickstarter has the advantage of that you don't have to make anything if you don't get enough money. And that you you can mail them all at once because everybody, you know, that's just the whole way Kickstarter works. Is everything gets mailed in one chunk. So it detaches the buying from the shipping part of it, which is nice. So we did a Kickstarter, got tons of people buying copies, and then we did the manufacturing run, put them all together, and then shipped like 300 things at once, which was a different kind of pain in the ass, but at least we only had to go to the post office like 3 times instead of 30 or 300.
Yeah, especially just like how crazy the game was shipping. I know I tried shipping like last week, and it was like $12 to like ship, you know, something that weighed maybe like 2-3 pounds just for like that one little thing.
Space Chem was small, which was nice, and the shipping was not too expensive, although they actually recently increased shipping rates with the United States Postal Service, so that kind of sucked. But that was after we did all the Space Chem. Now, the hardest part was that it actually turns out it's quite a feat to mail 300 things. Like, you have to... They will not go through all your items and calculate the price for you one at a time for them. You actually have to, like, figure out the postage yourself for people with no shipping experience. So we had to fill out probably 150 customs forms, and then we had to put on a whole bunch of stamps, and then in the end, they expect you to calculate look up the shipping zones and calculate the size of the package and buy the stamps and put them on yourself, and it just doesn't fit with reality. I don't know. So we just kind of, like, stumbled our way through that and then vowed to never do it again. Fortunately, there are fulfillment companies that will handle the shipping stuff for you, and if we ever do anything remotely close to that again, we're going to use somebody like that.
Well, this is another reason why digital distribution is the best. We're awesome.
Oh my god, yeah. We would not be doing this if there wasn't digital distribution. Like, fucking mailing out floppy disks.
Ah, the good old days, right?
I'm glad we're in these good old days.
Yeah, never.
Back to that. You just upload. Yeah. Literally, I mean, it was Steam. It's so great. I mean, we have a new build. Just press, like, a button, and it just uploads it all, and then it sends it out to everybody. They've all got the latest copy. You know, I'm nostalgic about things, but this is much more practical.
Yeah. I'm glad we've gone beyond, you know, floppy disks, CDs, and all that stuff. And it is crazy when you think about just how much of a big difference there's been. Like, I would say maybe like 10, maybe 15 years of the game industry. We've gone from, you know, you need like 10 floppies in your, you know, switch between floppies to get your game to run. And now we have, you know, entire platforms that just do the whole thing for us.
Yep.
Don't forget, now we're not tied to brick-and-mortar stores anywhere either. We can actually do it anywhere, produce stuff anywhere.
Which is also good, because brick-and-mortar stores would never carry Space Chem.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. And we don't need a publisher, so it's just all kinds of awesome future stuff.
Yeah. Crazy times. Let's see. Okay. Let's move on from Space Chem and talk about your next game. I know you've been working on education games, but your next, like, actual... I guess
real game.
Oh.
Our next fun game.
Oh. that is Ironclad Tactics.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about what that game is?
Yeah. So Ironclad Tactics is a fast-paced card-based tactics game that takes place in the Civil War with robots. So it's sort of like Plants vs. Zombies with Magic the Gathering. Does that sound tactics-y enough to you? Because if not, mix in some tactics games. And then, I don't know how tactics-y people think Plants vs. Zombies is, but it's somewhere in between, like, a tactics game and a collectible card game and Plants vs. Zombies. And it's all very real time, or almost real time. So, you know, it's technically turn based, like simultaneous turns, where you and your opponent make turns at the same time. But turns are very short, so it ends up being a much more fluid. You have to think a little bit quicker. But it's great if you're impatient, because you don't have to sit around waiting for your opponent to make a move. Right. So it just you kind of have to play it. I mean, it's really the thing. Like, it's if you like card games, or if you like tactics games, or if you like Plants vs. Zombies, like, there's a good chance you'll really like this game.
I think you just hit, like, all three of my, like, points in that one
Well, then you're going to love this game.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, what, actually, how do you develop the theme of Civil War and robots?
I actually made a game a long time ago that was about the Civil War with robots. I wanted to make a game that was about steam engineering, and at first it was going to be some sort of, like, magical steam thing, but I didn't figure out, it didn't feel like figuring out how the, like, the engineering of magic works. So instead I put in a time that, you know, where steam robots would be appropriate. And, you know, steampunk is definitely a common thing. Back when I made the first Bureau of Steam Engineering game, steampunk was less sort of, like, overhyped. But, you know, I still didn't want to do any, you know, like, typical steampunk is, like, super Victorian and people with, like, monocles and stupid hats and, like, obligatory, everybody's wearing goggles and, like, that's all kind of, like, dumb, and even then it was kind of overdone. So, and it was all very Victorian. One thing that, you know, as an American, that really, you know, that we learn a lot about and is sort of cool is American history and the Civil War. And there's not a lot of fantasy Civil War games, so it just sort of made perfect sense. Like, it's the Civil War with steam-powered robots, obviously. So... Yeah. We set out, you know, 2 years ago almost now, to make a sequel to the Bureau of Steam Engineering, and through lots of iteration and lots of throwing away not fun game ideas, we came up with this fast-paced card-based tactics game. But it was still about the robots in the Civil War.
I think it's really great as a gamer that I've heard, like, so many, like, crazy sayings that when you said Civil War was steampunk robots, like, it didn't, like, even, like, bother. Like, yeah, okay, I can see that. Like game from Gaslight, Clockwork Empires, Lovecraft, Steampunk, City Builder. Yeah, okay, I can see that happening. That doesn't bother me. All right, let me see it.
Recently there was a Civil War based.
That's
game.
Gettysburg Armored Warfare. So that is time travelers taking futuristic weapons back to the Civil War. This is not that. This is people in the appropriate time. There is no time travel in this game. Just to make that clear. We've had problems with that in the past in previous playtests. But there's no time travel. This is all people in an alternate history Civil War time period building robots with their technology, which happens to be slightly more robust and or lucky than ours.
Now, you talked about a few minutes ago about how the turns are going to be asynchronous. It's meant to be for fast-paced play.
It's synchronous. It's synchronous turns. Synchronous simultaneous turns.
All right. So is multiplayer going to be played by email, or will you be able to just, like, play with someone at the exact same time?
It only plays at the same time. So the game is, like, a turn lasts 5 seconds. Like, that would be the dumbest play-by-email game ever. So it's sort of like Frozen Synapse, in that you're making your moves at the same time that your opponent is. The difference is that there's no end turn button. Like, it's just going in real time while you're playing it. So there's still, like, distinct turns for purposes of calculations. It's not it's not like StarCraft. It's not real time. You're not, like, kind of send your guys in, pulling them back, send them in, pulling them back. Like, it's very much feels like a turn-based game, but it has a short attention span. So you are, like, you're making your moves at the same time. You can see as your opponents are playing cards and you're playing cards. It's sort of like a real-time card game, which you don't see a lot of. And you're playing your cards, and, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
it's instantaneous, and it's only that way. So it's not any of those other, like, asynchronous strategy games that have come out lately. Much in your face.
Yeah, I'm personally not a fan of those either, just because I'm, like, one of those guys that when I sit down to play, I just want to sit down and do it all at one time. I hate having to stop, you know, and then, you know, wait an hour or two for someone to make another move.
Exactly. Like, this is a game that was made for playing. I mean, not waiting. Like, this is not a game you play while you wash your dog or whatever. Like, this is a game that you sit down and play because it's a proper game.
Now, with the collectible card game aspect of it, I'm also a big fan of that kind of design. I think there is there's certain elegance to good CCG design. What led you to implementing CCG with Ironclad?
So we started off back when it used to be more of an engineering game, sort of like more like Space Chem, where you assembled these robots. We wanted to solve a problem, which is where it took a very long time to build your robots, and it was very detached from the action part. So we tried a mechanic where instead of sort of building robots in a little workshop and sending them out to battle, you would be building the workshops building the robots as you were fighting. So that involved you're kind of like quickly trying to assemble these robots and cobble them together, like, to the best of your ability to deal with things that are going on. And a really great way to have, like, random structural things is with a card-based system. So, you know, like your delta hand of pipes and parts, and you have to connect them together. So that was one of our iterations with a game like that. And we ended up throwing away all the steam pipes, but we kept the cards because it was fun, and it worked.
All right. So the cards themselves, are they buildings, units, or, like, both?
They are... There's four kinds of cards. You have infantry units, which are just, you know, little dudes with guns, typically. You have ironclads, which are the sort of the robots, but without weapons. Then okay. You have parts, which you can equip to any ironclad that you have in play, you can equip a part to it. And they're mostly weapons, but some of them are things like wrenches or trumpets that affect other units in other ways. And then you have tactics cards, which are, like, if you played Magic the Gathering, they're like instants, where they're okay. things that you can play, and they have, like, instantaneous effects. Like, you know, like, sort of the, like, you haven't played Ironclad Tactics yet, but you will soon. And there's the sort of the quintessential tactics card is called Maneuver. It's one of the trademarks of Ironclad Tactics is that units only move forward down their... It's a lane-based game.
Okay.
So it's a 9x4 grid, and units only move down their lane. But there's a card called Maneuver, which moves a unit into an adjacent lane. So, and it just does it instantaneously as you play it. You can actually use it to dodge. Like, sometimes there's sort of, like, real-time threats that you can dodge it with Maneuver. So it's sort of, I would say it's, like, the quintessential tactics card of Ironclad Tactics.
And that was actually my next question about how things play out like that. So as you were talking about, since it is synchronous, my units are moving at the same time that your units are.
And yes.
So do you play the cards, like, during, like, the, I guess, the turn-based phase of it, or during, like, the actual when they're moving around or both?
So there's basically two, there's four phases, but they're sort of split into two parts. Half the time the game is in what we call, like, play phase, where you can play cards, and half the time is in time that's divided between moving units, having them attack, and then removing dead ones. Okay. So basically you can't play any cards while they're moving or attacking. You can play it during the play phase. And so okay. they're sort of that you have about 5 seconds to make your move for that turn, and then everybody, like, moves forward and attacks, and it, like, does all that sort of clockwork stuff that happens automatically.
Okay. And in terms of, like, actual general play, what do you consider, like, the average play of, I guess, one game of Ironclad, or one match?
We aimed for about, I guess it depends on who you're playing against and, like, whether it's a campaign or whether you're playing against another human who's, like, perfectly matched to your skill level, but about 5 to 15 minutes per match. Okay. So it's not like Magic where, you know, it can last half an hour, you know, if it's, like, a really long drawn out. Mm-hmm. Like, no, it's about, like, 5 to 15 minutes, you know, pretty much using your attention the entire time.
Okay. Now, you were talking about how you can unlock new cards.
Absolutely.
In the game. So is there, like, a general balance that, like, as you play, you'll find, like, better infantry cards or better ironclad cards, or is, like, everything in, like, a general sense of balance? Like, there's no such thing as, you know, the best infantry card or the best this type of card.
Oh, yeah, we definitely looked at Magic in terms of balancing. There's no card that's across the board better than all other cards. You know, the better a card is, the more expensive it's going to be to play, so they're all sort of fair in that regard.
Okay.
Like, the power curve is pretty... It's like in Magic, you have stuff where, like, you have cards that are rare and that are... Usually a card that's rare is more complicated to use, but sometimes they're literally just better. We really don't have... We don't have any sense of rarity, so it's a pretty... The power curve of it is pretty consistent.
Okay.
So...
What type of, like, resource structure are you using with Ironclad? Like, is it something that's, like, earned every round? Is it, like, a resource you get, like, on the map? Okay, first one.
You have a resource called Action Points, and you constantly earn them just as, like, over time. In real time, you earn them,
okay.
And you spend them to play cards. So they normally come at a fixed rate, but a lot of the levels have objectives that you can capture. Typically, they're called flags, and you capture them with infantry. Which is a little tricky because infantry are squishy and they're prone to getting stepped on by ironclads. But if you send a friendly infantry unit over a flag, you capture it, and then that increases the rate at which you gain action points. So there's this really cool sort of dilemma as a player where do you want to take and hold and control the battlefield, or do you want to actually win the game and score points by crashing your units through the other player's base?
Okay, and that was actually my next question about how do you actually win?
How do you win? Yeah.
Yeah.
So ironclads, well, all units have a statistic called victory points, okay. Which is how much how many victory points they gain you if you send it through or, like, over the map to the other player's side of the board and off the board on that side. So you lose the unit, but you gain victory points equal to its victory score. So as a general principle, infantry do not give you victory, so they only have a purpose for holding, like, and fighting on the board, whereas ironclads are useful both as fighters on the board and as ways to score points. But there's this weird dilemma, because in order to actually score points, you have to sacrifice your units by sending them off the other side.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that also plays in the concept, since we're dealing with lanes, you have to sort of balance between, you know, do I follow all my lanes for defense, or, you know, do I just focus on one or two lanes and just, you know, try to bulldoze my way across the map.
Exactly. So there's lots, there's a ridiculous amount of strategy in this game, and it's awesome because it's really nothing like any other game out there. So it's a totally, you know, for people who really like getting into the strategy and understanding the strategy of a new game, you're gonna love it, because it's just not like other card tactics games.
And you say that you're also including a single-player campaign, which is also pretty rare for games with, you know, CCG-based design.
Yeah. It's both single-player and co-op campaign. So you can play it by yourself. Your friend can jump in and play it with you. They can leave. You can resume playing it by yourself. So it's everything. It's all, like, totally co-op ready. And super flexible in that regard. And the story part is probably more the single-player portion. The story campaign is more important than the random multiplayer aspect, because a lot of people who get this game in Humble Bundle aren't necessarily going to want to get all into the game and play competitively, but they are going to want to play a single-player game by themselves, you know, or with a friend that they trust and are okay with playing with and don't have to fight against, you know, someone that they can just play with and feel good about, as opposed to hating. And so we built this really strong single co-op campaign. It has a 70-page graphic novel story. Like, we're building this really sort of cutting-edge graphic novel story, so that even, you know, we've done a lot of considerations that even people who don't read comics or don't have experience reading comics or don't even like comics will still be able to enjoy it, because sort of bridging some of the difficult parts of the media.
Cool. Now, is co-op, like, basically, like, do they both control, like, the same side, or do I get my share of units and someone else gets their own share of units?
Yeah, so you both get to play units, and you can pretty much... So one of the core mechanics of the game is you toggle, like, a little stop-go thing for your units, whether they should advance or whether they should hold their ground. So you can only toggle stop-go for your units, but you can pretty much do everything else with your teammates. You can buff them, you can maneuver them, you can heal them, you can equip parts to them. And so you're pretty much... You're controlling the same pool of units, but, you know, like, only, in the end, like, only one person has final ownership over that unit.
Okay. Now, how many cards are you thinking about having in the full game when it's done?
The base set it's looking like it's going to be over 60 cards. And so, one of the also other caveats of this game, most games require you to build 60-card decks. Seems to be, like, an industry standard. We dropped that down to a 20-card deck to make deck building less difficult. Because that's like one of my least favorite parts of Magic the Gathering is building decks, because I never know what to put in them. And 60 cards is a lot, and it's really hard to estimate, like, the odds of pulling stuff out of a 60-card deck, because there's just so many freaking cards there. So we limit you to 20 cards in a deck. You can have up to 4 of each card, provided you've unlocked the full quantity of 4 for that card. And So from that, we have a 60-card plus base set that'll be unlocked in the game, and which is a lot to... You can build a lot of decks with it. There are also factions. We have different card factions. You can only take 2 factions in a deck together. Okay. So we've got factions like those. The Army faction, which is like the Union and Confederate armies. We've got like a mercenary faction. We've got a lot of factions. I don't want to spoil anything else, but there's a lot of factions, and that kind of brings out some of the story and fleshes it out in a way that shows up in the game.
And do the factions, like, have, like, different rules or different variations on, like, the basic unit types or basic card types?
Yeah, basically. I mean, one of the factions has no infantry. So they just don't have that. One of the factions has a lot of infantry, and one of the factions has a lot of weapons, just because they have better access to weapons. So they all have different kinds of things. Some of them, they don't have any faction-specific mechanics currently. But, well, actually, that's not true. One of the factions has... I don't want to spoil a lot of the stuff, but there's definitely, like... We've got a mechanic called chain cards, which is sort of our answer to card abilities. Because the game is so fast-paced, selecting a unit and telling him to do an ability via some, like, alternate menu would be a pain in the ass and would be largely hidden. So we have a thing called chain cards, which is when you play a card, some cards have chain cards, that when you play that card, it'll instantly draw a specific other card that targets that first card into your hand.
Okay.
So, like, we have there's a unit called the Raider. He runs really quickly across the field, and he can steal some action points from your opponent if he gets across. And he has a free card, a free ability that lets him maneuver for free once. And so when you play the Raider, this special card is drawn into your hand instantly and can be used. We also, this is one thing you didn't ask about that I will tell you about is the way hand management works. So we started early on with a mechanic where you draw cards manually, or like you can pay to draw a card.
Okay.
And it sucked because nobody remembered to draw a card. So the way we solved this is that the game will, every turn, will just shove a card into your hand. And if you have more than 5 cards in your hand, the oldest one is going to get pushed out and is just going to go into your discard pile.
Cool.
So it's pretty exciting and makes it fast-paced. And it has a, there's a very, I don't know, it's a totally different take on hand management.
It definitely sounds good. I know one of the last games I played that had like collectible card game aspects was Armageddon Empires, which was just like a war. It was more like a war game with the CCG elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the issues with, I guess, the learning curve, is that when you have to build these, you know, 50, 60 card decks, have like no idea. And then, you know, what if you don't take enough buildings, or if you don't take enough resources, and, you know, you're just screwed.
Yep. We've got a couple things like that. Like, one of the things we're still trying to solve to our satisfaction is people realizing the significance of infantry units. Like, I was able to tell you now, so I think you'd have a pretty good shot at understanding infantry units, but it's hard to tell people when you're not talking to them and they're not listening to you. So, we have a little bit of those problems, but otherwise, I mean, like, sort of as a, we were talking about Space Camp tutorials other, you know, earlier, as contrast to that, we have a really elegant, maybe not elegant, that's kind of tang. But we have a nice learning curve. I don't want to call my own stuff elegant, but you know, we focused really hard on improving the learning curve, because a lot of CCGs, they just throw you into it, and they're just like trying to learn Magic the first time. I pity anyone who tries to learn Magic through like the computer game version. It's just such a complicated game, you know. Like, you have to learn from a human being, you know. So we're trying to make a game that you can reliably learn from the computer.
You know, it's funny. I actually learned Magic the Gathering from the computer game over the actual card game.
Seriously?
My friends would never tell me the rules. I had to figure it out on my own.
But do you know all the rules? Like,
I think I do from the computer game.
I guess I don't even know how I tell it. Like, there's it's hard. I would have a hard time. You are a good, smart person. Then I think it's it'd be very hard to pick up on like a lot of the nuances of Magic through the computer tutorial.
Yeah, I think it's because of my exposure to people that played Magic.
You're kind of familiar, yeah.
Yeah, they were kind of resistant to teach me. I'm like, oh, okay.
I'm just going to watch.
I ended up with a lot of cards with no one to play with.
I tried playing Magic Gathering. I think it was like 96, 97. But of course, there was like no one around me who actually played it. So I like bought it down, just like reading that little book, going, okay, let's set up an imaginary game to teach you how to play. Like, what?
So that's the great thing about making a computer game, is that you don't have that problem. Like, it just plays, you know, you can play against the computer. It's totally fine. It's actually a really great way to teach people stuff, is not by telling them that it's possible or that it's a good idea, but by showing them, by having the enemy do it to them and crush them. Right. Literally, in this case, crushing units. You know, like, that's a big part of our stuff, is trampling, that where ironclads can run over top of infantry and squish them. So the way we show this to the player is just by having, like, setting up scenarios where the enemy will do it to them aggressively, and you almost, on one of the levels, you almost can't help but trample the enemy. So, like, that's something you can't do in a traditional card game.
For, like, the future of Ironclad, do you see yourself expanding games with adding, like, more cards down the line? Or will, like, the initial set be pretty much it for the foreseeable future?
We definitely... One thing we've heard a lot about is DLC. And I know that's going to totally terrify some players that we're talking about DLC and, like, openly, you know, considering it. But one thing we really want to do with this game is provide a way for players who really, really love this game and are really into it to let the game become as big as they want it to be. And this is sort of one of the problems we ran into with Space Cam, is that we filled it with way too many puzzles, but even like people who really liked the game couldn't get enough, you know? And they said, like, hey, like, if you made more, I want it. I would give you a little bit extra money for a little bit more content. So the game didn't really scale to what they wanted out of the game. So with this, especially because it's, you know, it's got a collectible aspect, and because it's got like a multiplayer aspect that Space Cam didn't, you know, there are going to be some players who are really going to hopefully love this game and get into it, and so that way they can continue playing on new maps and with new factions and new cards and experiencing new parts of the story and exploring parts of the universe. We want to put together and release content packs, which would be, you know, like, I don't know what the price would be, but, you know, for a much smaller price than the price of the game or the price of an expansion pack, you'll be able to pick up a content pack that contains a little mini campaign that has its own levels. Those levels are playable both as, like, part of a campaign where you can play with a friend against the computer, or as skirmish levels where you can play against friends and against other people, and also have it come with new cards that you unlock by playing those missions. One thing we'll never do is sell, like, you know, we have no desire to, like, sell booster packs or anything like that.
Holographic cards.
No holograms, man. No, we'd waste so much time trying to render holographic cards. That would be not even worth it. But, like, that's just, it's dumb, you know, and I know Magic does that, and I think it's the silliest thing ever, and people probably buy it, but we have no desire to release holographic cards or random booster packs. Yeah. You know, the way we want to approach this idea is with content. So it's a pack full of value that we are, and you know exactly what you're getting, and you're going to get to experience the joy of unlocking it in-game and, like, kind of earning it, you know. That's how we want to do it.
Will the, like, when you unlock the cards from, like, the DLC campaigns, will those cards be available for use in multiplayer, or will multiplayer only stick with the initial cards in the game?
The cards in the DLC packs will be a core part of playing with multiplayer. We have no desire to, you know, I mean, there's an incentive there, like, to have cards that come out in the DLC packs be very powerful, so that way you have to, you know, pay to win. We have no desire to do this. The way we see it is that people who really like the game are going to want variety. Like, it's not just about winning. It's winning and experiencing variety, or winning with, like, a clever technique or something. So, you know, we want to release some, you know, expansion packs that have new units, new mechanics, and give people new ways to play the game. And, you know, give them, maybe you see, like, oh, if I combine, you know, this new mechanic with this old one, then I can pull off something really awesome. Like, that kind of, you know, more emergent, you know, being able to take advantage of it.
Sounds
not
cool.
Simply, it has bigger numbers, I have to buy the DLC. Like, no.
And that actually takes me to the next question. When you're playing online, will there be, like, matchmaking in terms of stats, or, you know, if I buy 2 out of 4 DLC and someone buys, you know, 1 out of 4 and stuff like that?
There's two ways to play multiplayer, and we've actually siloed them off into 2 separate sections.
Okay.
There's, sometimes you play with your friends, and sometimes you play with random strangers, random assholes on the internet. And so the sort of de facto mode is that when you go to play the game, you're always in a multiplayer lobby. There'll probably be a way to turn it off if you really want to go in hermit mode. But when you go to play, you can invite your friends, and then they can come join your game, and they can come join your party, and you can play multiplayer together. And one of the cool side effects of the way we do the maps in Ironclad Tactics is that every level is a campaign level, obviously. Every level is also a skirmish. So we take that level, you know, like, we have a battle that takes place in front of the White House, you know, that we have a skirmish level where we take that level and then rearrange the things in it to turn it into a unique skirmish level where you can play against your friends.
Okay.
We also do things like Nemesis mode, where we take a level where you fight against a boss and then let one of your friends be the boss.
Ah, that's cool.
We have puzzles where they're sort of like single player or co-op ones, but instead of just trying to win the level by fighting, you're trying to sort of puzzle out a solution where you have a specific hand and you have to play it in a certain way and learn about the mechanics. We also have the matchmaking mode you were asking about, where you can go into a different mode, and so one of the differences here is that you're willing to wait on your friends to build a deck. Maybe they're like, oh, let me tweak my deck, give me a second, and then you'll wait on them. But not when you're playing against a stranger. You really don't want that mess. So yeah. We have a different, totally different channel called like a random skirmish, and what it will do is you go in and this menu, and you pick your deck, and you get all ready to play, and then you hit matchmake, and then it'll just pull somebody else out of the matchmaking queue, and then you'll play together, but you're both already ready to play, so you're not waiting on somebody to put their deck together. And it sort of, it fits the framework. It puts you on maps that you'd want to play against a random stranger, you know, not one that's going to be asymmetrical and unfair. And it's sort of just targeting the two separate, totally different attitudes in multiplayer play.
All right. Now, Earl, you said, I think the maps were, was it 4x9 in terms of, like, the rows and the columns?
Yeah, 9. So there's 4 rows. Right. Each one has 9 squares across.
Okay. For, like, the general map structure, is that standard across all maps, or will some maps have, like, different ratios?
Some are missing. There's 2 maps that I can think of off the top of my head where we chop off one of the rows. So there's only 3 rows instead of 4. Okay. But usually it's 9x4. It's pretty. If we added more rows, it would be too hard to maneuver to reach adjacent guys, and it wouldn't be very fun to just have it be that everybody's going down empty rows. You know, like, you'd have no chance of blocking. So 4 is sort of the sweet spot for the number of rows.
Okay.
And 9 is good because it's odd. So there's a square down the middle that is equal from both sides, and it's about the right distance for things to take the right time. And it's interesting because the longer you make it, the further your units have to walk, which makes the reaction time poorer. That, like, you know, that it increases the chance that somebody is going to do something that you can't counter because they're further down the board. So we sort of, we tested a bunch, and that's how we got to 9x4. It was no accident.
Cool. All right. So I guess just to wrap up, you know, like the standard, you know, questions, when do you have an idea for when Ironclad will be released?
August? Before PAX? That's what we're hoping.
Okay.
So we're going to be, if everything works out, if we're lucky, we'll be at PAX with a totally playable released version of the game.
Okay.
And a bunch of people sweat.
And what distribution platforms are you looking for it?
Steam is what we're hoping for. The game uses, we've been developing against the Steam APIs, so we're hoping that we'll actually get on Steam, the store, and because the game's all fully Steamworks enabled, like to the best of the platform.
Okay.
So it's a great platform, actually. Yeah. You get like free voice chat, free lobbies, free, you know, player friends list, all that. Free DLC ownership. You get tons of awesome stuff like that.
Here's my question, though: free TF2 items?
I hope so. We'll see. We were careful to design some things that would make amazing TF2 items. So
I beg you, for more TF2 items.
Do you still play TF2?
I do. I'm all about TF2. That's like the only game I play.
We've got some stuff that maybe if we're lucky, they'll let us do.
Nice.
That would be awesome.
One other question I have, I almost forgot, regarding the multiplayer. You said in the single player that we'll have, you know, you can play like two against AI. For multiplayer matches, is it always going to be 1-on-1, or will it be, you know, 2-on-2 or anything like that?
Currently, at launch, we're planning to have it do that. Matchmaking is always 1v1, but if there's, you know, compelling, if there's enough people asking for it, we'd implement a 2v2. But we're sort of testing the water with that. That's the area that we know the least about. Like, I know how to make a single-player game. No less about making competitive multiplayer games. So that's something that we're going to just sort of, you know, dip our feet in, listen a lot to what people are asking for, and try out lots of stuff like that and really respond to let our players drive the competitive multiplayer aspect of it, because they know more about it than we do, for sure.
All right. It sounds cool. Ken, do you have any questions you want to ask?
No, it just sounds like a great concept for a game. You already sold me on it. And if there's TF2 items, you double sold me on it. I'll buy two copies.
We had control over that, too. But yeah.
It definitely sounds like a great game, and definitely keep us in the loop. It sounds like I said, you had me at CCG Tactics and Plants vs. Zombies. That, you know, hit almost like every checklist in my head.
You had me at Civil War Robots.
Awesome. Well, we've got both of you with the one tagline, so that's good. So, you and your listeners can actually check out IroncladTactics.com. We're going to be posting news. We've got screenshots and a little teaser trailer up there. We'll have more information coming soon. And we have a mailing list that if you sign up for, you can get into the beta program. So,
awesome.
You guys should do that.
Definitely.
All right. So, I think with that, we're going to wrap it up here.
Okay.
I would like to thank Ken and Zach for being on this week.
No problem.
Thanks for having me.
And you are definitely welcome back. And I would definitely love to talk to you again. Either closer to Ironclad or talk more about that in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to be a future guest on our podcast or write a piece for the site, you can find the link to that on our front page. Just click on the Submissions Wanted link and send us an email. And with that, we're going to end here for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I would like to thank everyone for listening in. And have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.